Anne and Chris Chivers. Meanwhile, here on Radio 4 FM, we have the concluding episode of our Book of the Week, Hopeful, the autobiography written and read by the comedian and actor Omid Djalili. It's the 1990s, and Omid has been living in Czechoslovakia, where he's set up a successful theatre company. But unexpected events in London are about to bring him home.
One weekend in February 1995, I called home, feeling guilty that I hadn't been in touch for a while. My sister tentatively informed me that my mother wasn't well, and maybe I should come home as soon as possible. I asked what she meant by as soon as possible, and she replied, maybe this week. My mother had kept her illness a secret from my family for a good 2 years. She had cancer and had come to the decision that it was now okay for me to know. I was angry that I had not been told earlier, but my mother had been adamant that I should know nothing until it was absolutely unavoidable. I travelled back to London immediately. My mother was in the newly built Chelsea and Westminster Hospital. I was given instructions to visit a ward on the third floor. In the bed by the window, a tiny woman lay asleep. This figure bore no resemblance to my larger-than-life lioness of a mother. She eventually woke up. And, as she spoke, I began to recognise her again. She told me not to worry and that she was fine with everything. I asked what she meant by that, and she said bluntly, "Marg, death." I told her not to say such foolish things. "I'm dying." "No, you're not." "I don't want you to be upset. I know it, and I'm all right with it." I had a dream the other night that I was entering the next world, and my father said, "What are you doing here? It's too early." And I said, "I'm ready now." And he said, "But it's not your time." And I replied, "I know, but there's no point hanging around. I might as well come now." And he said, "All right, come on then. But don't rush. You're always rushing." I was floored by her bluntness. One night, I awoke at 1:30 a.m. I had a distinct feeling that my mother wanted to see me. I got out of bed, drove to the hospital, and there she was, awake, as if waiting. She seemed very happy I'd come. "Are you allowed to be here?" "Don't care. I wanted to see you." She was delighted by my spontaneity. In that 1 hour, we said everything we needed to say to each other. My mother declared that I'd always been good and she had never regarded me as a problem. She recalled how she used to let me play on my own, and I was happy, sometimes for hours, just looking out the window. In all of this, there was a slight subtext that perhaps my mother had been concerned I might not have been quite all there. But she told me that she thanked God for giving her a child who made such little fuss. "I should have played with you more. I'm so sorry. Please forgive me." At this point, she started crying, overcome with regret. I told her the truth, that I was happy playing alone. I enjoyed my rich fantasy world. I was grateful to have been left to my own devices and always felt sorry for children whose parents hovered around them. My mother was on a roll and reminded me of a fortune teller who had once stayed in our home. Apparently, she told my mother that her third child was going to do something unusual and spectacular. My mother was crying, telling me, "I'm so sad I won't be able to see it. I'm so sad. You have no idea." I was touched by her belief in me and I held her hand. She told me that I was her Omid, her hope. I made a vow in my head to dedicate every show, every live performance, every appearance anywhere to her, and to ask continuously for her assistance. What I learned most from my mother, which in a sense is at the heart of a comedian's spirit, was her immense capacity to burst the balloon of self-importance. This attitude of my mother's was neatly summed up in 1989 at the Etc. Theatre Club in Camden, when the Coconuts incident from my childhood was revisited in an awful echo. I was appearing in a two-hander called The Zoo Story by Edward Albee. The director had boosted me up, saying I was the best dramatic actor he'd ever seen. The opening scene of the play, set entirely in Central Park, New York, involved me walking on, casing the joint, and noticing someone seated on a bench. I had to approach this character, then, having second thoughts, back away and leave the stage. After a beat, I was told to reappear. In other words, follow basic stage directions for less than a minute with a view to building an atmosphere of unspoken tension. To my horror, as I walked on, there seemed to be a rather crackling and dangerous atmosphere, punctuated by odd murmurs. As I approached the park bench, the crowd fell silent. As I had second thoughts and edged away, there were titters. As I backed towards the exit, the laughs were building, so I stopped. This only served as an unintentional dramatic pause. When I left the stage, a huge guffaw erupted. I stood backstage, literally shaking, not understanding the root of this unsolicited hysteria. I waited for the laughs to die down, and then made my re-entrance. An ironic cheer of "Hooray!" went up at my reappearance. This set the tone for the rest of the evening, and sadly, every moment where poignancy was intended was met with gales of laughter. At the end of the story, my character gets stabbed and dies. Surely this would stop everyone laughing. The director had instructed us not to take a curtain call, but instead, as the lights fade, I was told that I should stay frozen in my final dead position. When the moment of my stabbing actually arrived, the audience roared their appreciation. But instead of making their way out, shaken and respectful, they all remained in their seats, as if waiting for a punchline. By this point, no one was sure what was going on. This was actually our intended reaction, as the director was seeking to milk the delicious beat of awkwardness before the audience leaves. Powerful stuff. However, the director had not banked on my mother being in the crowd. She'd been sitting supportively in the front row, but was clearly uncomfortable that people did not seem to have clear instructions. She was also concerned that I might have been hurt, and her gasps and shrieks during the various fight scenes had been distracting, to say the least. She decided to get up and approach me on stage, tottering on ludicrously high heels, with her fur coat floating around her shoulders. It was summer, and we were in a cramped fringe venue. With a powerful hand gesture, she indicated, "Hang on a minute," to the crowd. Everyone was gripped, and now convinced the play had not indeed finished. Was it possible this genius maverick director had constructed an explosive new ending to Edward Albee's masterpiece? In the thick silence, my mother's voice was painfully audible as she whispered in my ear, "Are you really dead?" Inevitably, this was turning into a comedy gold situation, and she got a huge laugh. I was forced to reply just so she would leave me alone with my art. I had no choice but to hiss back, "No, just go. Please, just go." My mother turned triumphantly to the crowd, proclaiming, "It's okay, everybody. He is not dead. We can go. Come on." Naturally, this sparked a final round of whoops and cheers as people followed her lead and started making their way out. My mother's actions on that day, and ever since, provided me with an acute awareness regarding the perils of voluntarily placing oneself under public scrutiny and expecting to be taken seriously. Perhaps this was why I felt so comfortable with the conceptual integrity I found in ITV's Splash, a diving show fronted by Olympic medal winner Tom Daley. There was honesty there, coupled with a craziness that felt downright sensible. I may not be very good at witty banter on panel shows, but reckless acts of absurdity, no problem. Splash, in January 2013, brought forth a flurry of epiphanies, all occurring as I hurtled, age 47, overweight, and wearing a spangly onesie, to possible injury and death from a 10-metre diving board live on television. It was the ultimate act of optimism, flinging myself from a great height and trusting the universe to catch me. It occurred to me during the semi-final that I must possess a specific personality type that best gathers philosophical insights about existence whilst suspended mid-air. As I teetered on the edge of the board, time slowed down, and I felt oddly peaceful, just like when I nearly fell out the back of a car onto the Tehran motorway. As I fell from the board, learning point number one came to me. It's only when you've fallen flat on your face that things start to happen. So you might as well jump, because it doesn't matter if you fall. Falling is good. As the bottom of the pool continued to rush towards me, I was struck by learning point number two. Jumping into the void and being myself had, in many ways, been an attempt to connect with my mother's example of fearlessness. Perhaps it was part of the grieving process, but the first bit of stand-up I ever did was about my mother's outrageous front to haggle in McDonald's. It's a simple joke based on the tension of feeling embarrassed about the way she ordered our food. Two Big Mac, two chip, two Coke, please. How much? That'd be £3.78. Okay, I give you £1. Learning point three. Had my mother lived, she would definitely have ended up in one of my shows and would have probably upstaged me mercilessly. Learning point number four. I miss my mum. She would have loved Splash. That the British public seemed to have accepted me became learning point number five. This hit me as I became dimly aware of the crowd cheering as I flew through the air. I've spent most of my career, and indeed my life, trying to figure out who I am in order to make some kind of contribution as a British-born Iranian, often feeling an outsider. I've banged on about being an Iranian in my stand-up, but when David Beckham scored against Greece to send us, look, I said us, to the World Cup of 2002, I got lightheaded, choked, and passed out. I don't think the audience of Splash cared remotely about my ethnic origin. I was a balding and corpulent middle-aged man doing something intrepid. As my head smacked the water, learning point number six hit me with full force. It's all well and good to live the dream, soaring from a great height, but how many times can you expect your nearest and dearest to continue hauling you metaphorically and literally out the water? Time to grow up, I thought, as my nose narrowly missed scraping the bottom of the pool. Wisdom is only gained in hindsight. You actually learn nothing from falling flat on your face. It's what you do afterwards that counts. I read somewhere that the great landscape painter Turner never painted scenes that actually existed. Instead, he replicated a hedge from here, a stream from somewhere else, a tree there, a stray dog, maybe some cattle, and he threw them all together to create a miraculous and healing view so authentically lovely that art lovers were convinced of its existence and wanted to go there. Unlike Turner, everything I've said is true and really happened. But I hope I too have created an emotional landscape that feels familiar, regardless of whether or not you've worked as a medical translator, had a snowball fight in Iran, hugged Mel Smith, or stumbled unwittingly into stand-up comedy. I've been Omid Jalili. You've been a great audience. In the spirit of my first gig where it all went wrong, but somehow it all went right, can I start again?
Omid Jalili was reading from his autobiography, Hopeful. It was abridged by Lou Kemp and produced by Kirsty Williams. The news is next here on Radio 4. Then Jeanette Winterson talks to Jenny Murray about her groundbreaking novel, Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, a semi-autobiographical account of a young girl discovering her sexuality and its place in women's writing almost 30 years after its publication. And crossword culture has been male-dominated for years, but why are fewer women than ever making it as crossword compilers? That's in Woman's Hour in a couple of minutes.
Where else to discuss a philosophical conundrum but in the pub?
Each week, professional philosophers and barroom philosophers join together in a state of advanced refreshment and think through a problem.
Matthew Sweet asks, will the sun rise tomorrow? Or should we take a pill that would make us less aggressive?
You should actually suffer the consequences and, you know, be dragged off, screaming and shouting off to the clink or whatever.
The drug runs out and it's like Planet of the Apes or something. Everyone's running in the streets.
The Philosopher's Arms returns for a new series on Monday night at 8 on BBC Radio 4.